Hi, I'm Dr. Lucy Blue, and this is the second episode of our Dive and Dig in-depth podcast that reveals highlights from the full interviews we featured in our first series. This week, we're exploring deep time with Dr. Helen Farr from the University of Southampton. We will be journeying to the Southeast Asian seas to discover how early humans navigated the oceans over 60,000 years ago. We will also attempt to understand what encouraged people to take to the seas. Threat, rising sea levels, or just simple human curiosity? Here's Helen to tell us more.
The interesting thing is that when we think about ancient seafaring, the general public idea, the image that comes into head is of the Vikings, of the Phoenicians even. But actually, when we look at human history, it's also tied with really early seafaring in deep time and coastal navigation and things like that. So I'm looking at some of the earliest direct evidence we have of seafaring, the movement of people into Australia, New Guinea, from island Southeast Asia. So some of the earliest evidence we have in that region dates back to 800,000 years ago in the island of Flores. And when we're looking at movement into Australia itself, you're looking at distances of, say, 70 kilometres by around 65,000 years ago, or maybe even earlier.
Wow. Actually, I genuinely didn't realise that it was so early.
Yeah.
Okay, how do we know that people were moving those distances, first of all? Because let's talk about the seafaring in a minute, but what's the evidence of that action actually happening?
So the really earliest dates, the ones where we're looking at early hominins, those generally are just evidence of people arriving on islands. So it's not direct evidence of seafaring. It would be a little, you know, it would be a little much to perhaps say that. But people did cross gaps between islands. They crossed spaces, water spaces and channels. Getting through island Southeast Asia, there's a gap known as the Wallace Gap. It's where you go between two very different geographical areas, and the other mammals, they don't cross that gap. This is something that hominins are doing, which is very special. And I think that that involves seafaring of some sort of level. Other people have called it just culturally enhanced floating or something like that, but I'm not sure. I mean, those really early dates, we have examples of sites, for example Matamenge, where we have very early lithics, and we know for sure that those are lithics. We know it's an archaeological site. That is something which is anthropogenic. It's culturally made material that we're finding on those sites at those early dates. So we know people must have travelled across some sort of stretch of water. The Australian evidence is a little bit different, because we suddenly have multiple sites and this big expansion of people into an area that they may not have already been in before. So when we're talking about that 65,000-year-old evidence, you're looking at sites like Majabebe on Arnhem Land, with the earliest date is potentially 65,000. So we know that people must have travelled into that region by at least 65,000, unless, of course, you follow a different worldview, like many indigenous Australians, that you've actually always been on country, they've always been there. So it's also important to remember that there are many different narratives that you can investigate seafaring through, and different lenses to understand the world when we're talking about human origins.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that the idea of perspective and belief and identity in your own culture and your own place in your world is really important. But before we move on to that, though, I'm interested to know, so at this later period, only a mere 60,000 years ago, people were moving. What sort of distance are we talking about at this stage?
Well, so that's the interesting thing. So if we're looking at early seafaring in the Australian region, island Southeast Asia and Australia, then you're looking at people moving from what we know as the Sunda Shelf. So that's island Southeast Asia, but imagine it during lower sea level periods. So many of the islands are actually connected. And so that's the Sunda Shelf. And we actually know, or we talk about Australia at that time period as being Sahul, which is Australia, New Guinea, Tasmania, all connected. So you're looking at a very different geography. And it's the first thing you need to do is understand where those coastlines were because of sea level change during this multiple glacial cycles, glacial periods. So to understand the distances, you really need to understand what the sea level was doing and what the land was doing, because of course, this isn't just our last glacial period. It's not our last ice age, but a few back. So we're talking about what, if you're looking at the dates of around the 65,000, you're looking at a cold spell, which we know as marine isotope stage 4. So sea levels would have been lower, possibly not as low as they were around 20,000 years ago, but you're still looking at distances. If you say, look at the crossing, the various routes have been suggested, by the way, since even the 1970s by someone called Birdsall. And the southern route was from through island Southeast Asia and a migration across the sea of about 70 kilometres into northern Australia from Timor or Timor Roti. Other possible routes involve island hopping, so smaller distances, 20, 30 kilometres, but multiple islands and into New Guinea. But actually, some of those might have been harder because of the currents and the seafaring capability as well at that time.
So, okay, we're talking about, you know, directional seafaring, something that is deliberate, the numbers are demonstrating that this wasn't just a happenstance. So what do we have any sense of what types of vessels, what types of boats or rafts they may have been using at this period?
So that's a really good question, Lucy, because it's something that has been argued for a long time. If you accept that the really earliest dates, the million-year-old dates, the 800,000-year-old dates, are just some sort of accidental floating, you know, along drifting along with bits of flotsam in the sea, perhaps. But this is a very different thing. This is about technology and boat technology and skill that we see at such an early age. And actually, when you're talking 65,000 years ago, we see stone tools being preserved and we see faunal assemblages, bits of bone, things like that. But really, how much do we see of this cognitive insight into what people are doing and how they're traveling through the landscape or understanding their world? And I think that's where seafaring gives us this direct lens into some of that, which is why for me it's so exciting. But having said that, we don't have a boat. So there's no boats preserved in the archaeological record dating to about that time. So we have Mesolithic boats. We have the Pesce log boat in the Northern Hemisphere, which is about 10,000 years old, but that's not very close chronologically to the time depth that I'm talking about. So we have to sort of use a little bit of general knowledge about simple boat technology. So what kind of boats could people have been using and what sort of raw materials would have been available at the time in those locations? So you have to understand the paleo environment and both on the coast for the vegetation, the trees, things like bamboo rafts, for example, could have been used, or simple log boats. You need to understand the technology, so what kind of toolkit people had, and you have to also understand the marine environment for trying to recreate or rethink and model what kind of conditions that boat would have had to have crossed for a successful voyage. So if we put all these things together, some sort of simple boats, simple kind of technology, if you're looking at rafts, then you're looking at composite technologies and needing rope or cordage to basically tie it all together and secure it. But if you go up to that Northern Australian area today and stand on the coastline, it's not exactly going to be a sea that you would instantly want to build yourself your own raft and set off into. And there's quite a lot of danger involved in it. It's quite a lot of risk. So certainly in terms of construction, in terms of skill, it's in the technology for a successful reaching of land, and skills and knowledge about the environment would have been important as well. And we've run all sorts of models. So I've been working on an ERC-funded research project called the ACROSS Project. And one of the things that we've been trying to do is to recreate that ancient marine environment and understand where the coastlines were in order to investigate what kind of boats could have successfully made these crossings and what people would have had to have done or to have known, for example. Would they have to take provisions or water supply with them? Things like that. And we've modelled just plain drifting, and we've modelled directed seafaring as well. And it does seem that if you actually want to survive a crossing of those sorts of distances in those marine conditions, we would be looking at directed seafaring. So probably paddled, I imagine, as the simplest form of propulsion.
No, that's amazing. And so what, I mean, you're drawing on a whole range of different types of data sets here. What bits of information are you pulling on to try and come to those conclusions? You mentioned also the Aboriginal beliefs within that. That's quite an interesting perspective on things as well, which I believe quite strongly, you know, can give us insight into things in the past. They don't necessarily provide the answers, but...
Yeah, I'm taking a really wide interdisciplinary approach because it's so deep in time. I think that's the only way we can just nuance the stories that we tell about early seafaring. So in this particular region, really to understand what's going on, you have to be looking at the geology, you have to be looking at the coastal geomorphology, so the coastal changes, you have to understand sea level rise, climate change, the paleo environments that we can get from pollen records, and all of that we're doing through things like using 2D and 3D offshore seismic data that's been collected by the oil and gas industry. And we combine that with core or borehole data to get an idea, I guess, an interpretation of what that landscape was like, which is now submerged, and where those coastlines were. And so that's the key thing. It's understanding where the coastlines were at that depth of time to understand then. We can model the water, we can understand what the marine environment is doing. We're also looking at the archaeology, of course, thinking about where sites are located on the present day coastline, what sort of environments people are inhabiting, cave sites and open sites, and the shale middens, of course, in this part of the world. And we're also thinking about archaeogenetics. So, where do we see population connections through ancient DNA and also modern DNA populations? So can you connect different regions, for example, through New Guinea into Australia or through some of those islands, through different population groups being recognised in the DNA? So we're doing multiple strands of evidence, and the indigenous histories, the oral traditions, are really important within this, because that's another really crucial and deep and rich strand of understanding the past and understanding how people in that region have navigated and used the marine environment and the coastal environment through really quite deep periods of time. Because in those stories, we can also see narratives of Holocene, so the last 10,000 years, sea level change. Now, that's recorded in these stories. So you can begin to sort of see that actually this is a really valid way of understanding that coastline, because these stories have persisted and they've grown for at least 10,000 years, if not more. And that's absolutely incredible. I mean, that wasn't something that I started out thinking about when I was thinking I was going to be looking at early seafaring.
No, it's amazing the way you're sort of painting this three-dimensional picture by bringing in all those different strands and thinking about all those different ways of approaching different data sets in order to sort of build up this, I don't know, a hypothetical understanding on some level. But the more you do that, the more nuance and the more specific detail you draw from that. So from the knowledge of the people who currently live in these landscapes, you're talking about seafaring, about navigating. Do their stories that you refer to give us insight into any of the specifics? Are they using line of sight? Are they looking at stars? How are they literally navigating across those spaces? Because obviously that gives us an insight, presumably, into how people may have done it in the past.
Yes, that's a really good question. There certainly are little glimpses of things like understanding of movement through space, but not in the same way as you get, for example, in Polynesia. We're looking at more local coastal use of boats and actually things like bark canoes and rafts and things like that. And we see how they're moving locally, and there are stories about movement through, of course, through the landscape, around some of the larger islands and further along the coast as part of their Dreamtime stories. But you know, these are more, you can't mine them for the information about the boats and about seafaring practice. You can sometimes get a sort of idea about something that's traditionally been happening, potentially the fish traps, the fishing practices, things like that. But you have to be really careful, because of course these are very old stories and they're culturally important, they're culturally sensitive. Everything's tied up as one. It's about origins and belief and landscape and being and identity. And it's very difficult to disentangle it. In fact, you wouldn't disentangle it. So you have to see it as holistic. And it is cultural knowledge, it's intangible heritage, it needs to be preserved, it needs to be valued, and it needs to be looked after, really. It's not something that we can just literally take bits and pieces out of it to fit into our research. But it does, however, give a richness to understanding, on the other hand, this environment and maritime activity and a time depth to this maritime activity, which is just really fascinating, because having worked in the Mediterranean, we just don't have that. Even with these different worldviews, the Western science view that has, you know, that accepts the out of Africa story and about our progression through different hominins to end up as who we are, modern Homo sapiens sapiens. And that story is obviously one in which I'm based, in which I'm academically based, and through which I am studying big picture questions of movement of humans around the world in deep time. But also, we have a different kind of narrative, on the other hand, and we need to, it's an intangible cultural heritage which needs to be looked after and protected. And it's really interesting to see how you can hold both ideas and simultaneously, which are so different, but actually can be held and sit side by side. And they can tell us something about maritime activity in the past, which we just wouldn't get using other forms of information, other kinds of scientific data.
No, I couldn't agree more, because it's that sort of in-depth, intangible knowledge, the sort of knowledge of place and identity and belief that is so important, I think, to this whole holistic way of thinking, as you say. You've painted a really, really rich and beautiful picture of these landscapes, and it's really incredibly exciting work. Just just grasping this concept that people were able to move around, you know, having made the decision to cross from A to B, however, as you said, daunting that may have been, and small craft, 60 plus thousand years ago, is quite remarkable. But then actually starting to understand, to pick that apart and see how, why, when and where, and it's just fantastic work. It's really exciting, Helen.
You know, I think that if I had seen that, or I had seen into the future 20 years ago when I was studying Neolithic seafaring, and I had thought, oh, I'm going to be studying Pleistocene seafaring, I would have just thought I'd gone a little loopy, that I was on the fringe. But as the dates are going back and back, 65,000 years ago, it doesn't even seem that old. I mean, it's old, but it's, you know, I think it's going to go back even further. And of course, we don't have the boats. So, you know, as you said, we are in many ways, how do you interpret it? It's the story we're telling. But actually, if we know that people crossed these water bodies and we know what the distance was, we know what the climate was like and the marine environment was like, the ocean currents and the tides, and we know all of that, then actually we can really look at what that entailed. And when we go right back in time, well, you know, it's just so much of an engaging story about what humans are doing. We talk about the out of Africa migrations and dispersals, but when you get to the end of land, when you have to jump off and cross a body of water, we can all picture what it's like when you're stood there on the coast and you're looking out to sea, and if you can't see the land on the other side, you know, what makes you get into that boat or onto that raft? And not just on your own, but with your, maybe with your social group, with your family, because let's face it, it's not just one person who's crossing. We're looking at a population getting across successfully. So what makes people just step off? Is it something that's happening on land, which means that you have to go? Risks or no risks, you're going to have to go. So what could that be? Is that something to do with the environment, something to do with the local environment, the climate? How does this fit to the bigger pictures we have of what's happening in the world at that time? We've got, it's a bit colder, it's a bit drier, we have lower sea levels, but, you know, would that be enough to make people want to expand? Or would it be rising sea levels that would make people want to expand because their world would be becoming more insular? So there's lots of questions about what would push people to get into boats and explore. Or really, is this something about just simply being human? And it's that inquisitive nature of what's over there? Is there something better over there? The grass must be greener. Let's get in the boat and set off and get going. Because there is always that as well. When you stand and you look at the horizon on the beach and you think, where are those birds going to? What's happening over there? And of course, you know, these people really knew their landscapes. They really understood them. They knew how to find raw materials, and coasts are great places to live because you have rocks outcropping which you can use for your stone tools. You have fresh water coming in from the rivers draining into the sea. You've got wetland areas with fish and fowl, and you've got the marine environment, and you've got animals coming in as well for hunting. So you have all these resources all coming together. And a case has been made for the coast being a sort of expressway of human migration. So people are able to go from one resource area to the next following the coast because there's a certain sort of similarity. You can do the same things. You've got everything you need to live well. And that's, you know, what comes as then a really other interesting idea. And really, that is that if we're looking at just the last glacial maximum period, say about 30 to 20,000 years ago, you're looking at sea levels being around 130 to 120 meters below where they are presently. And that means, if you look at that time period, about 22 million square kilometers of the world's continental shelf would have been exposed. So when I say continental shelf, that's what we now class as being underwater around our coast. So that would have been exposed, that would have been land that could have been possibly occupied. People could have walked across it, they could have camped on it, they could have hunted on it. It was part of their landscape. And that is a huge amount of land that has been now swallowed up by rising sea levels of the Holocene period, the last 10,000 years. So where we are today, sea levels are quite high. And actually for most of human history, sea levels have been a lot lower. So when we're trying to think about how we recreate movement and activity in deep time, this coastal area is really important to understand and not forget that, whether it's looking at the seafaring crossings themselves or whether it's looking for sites which are now submerged and underwater. And we're finding more and more submerged sites on these paleo-submerged landscapes, so ancient submerged landscapes around the coast, all around the world, in the Northern Hemisphere and in the Southern Hemisphere as well. And through these sorts of studies where we're looking at the offshore data to reconstruct and interpret landscapes and coastal areas which are now submerged, which weren't in the past, we can also highlight areas where we think people might have been liking to live and what they might have been doing because of these lovely access to raw materials and things. But we can also target areas for further examination where we think the archaeology may in fact be preserved. And this is really exciting because we've got these early sites in Australia, possibly 65,000 years ago in the Northern Territory. But if we go offshore off the Northern Territory, do we have them even earlier? Are we going to start finding much, much earlier sites which are now submerged? And that's really, really exciting for the story of Australia, for human origins, but also just really understanding where people were moving in deep time and what they were doing.
How are you finding these sites, though, the submerged landscape sites? What technologies are you applying specifically to locate them or to at least imagine where they might be because you're mapping different previous landscapes, paleo landscapes?
So the first step is really to understand what the paleo landscape was and what the sea level change has been. So we have in the northern Australian shelf, what we've been doing is a really high resolution analysis of the seabed, but also sub-bottom. So we've been using 2D and 3D seismic data sets that were collected for the oil and gas industry. And what you can do is you can process them because the oil and gas industry aren't interested in the surface layers. They're interested in what's really, really deep. And as archaeologists, we want to know, you know, really just a few tens of meters below the surface. So you process the data to make it higher resolution and then you can examine it. And what we're seeing is we can identify different layers, so we can different surfaces. Including the marine isotope stage 4 surface. So we correlate it and match it by using our core and borehole data, so we've got dates.
So that's the period of the 65,000 roughly years ago, this earlier sea crossing. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So that's 71 to 57,000, which is a really nice period for encompassing lots of these early sites and maybe a little earlier as well. And we have a low stand at that period. So MIS-4, as it's known, is a low stand. So it would have been the sea levels were lower than they are today. Around 80 metres lower. So that's quite a lot of shelf, actually, that would have been exposed. And then looking at the seismic data, what we can see is we can do landscape, reconstructions where we can see paleo channels and the changing nature of the paleo channels. We can identify different areas like estuarine areas, bird's foot deltas, dune sequences, you know, all the things that archaeologists and geomorphologists like to see, because that helps you understand what's happening in that environment. And the great thing about the Australian area is that submerged landscape studies haven't been, it's not something that's really taken off until fairly recently, even though it was almost 40 years ago that Nick Fleming first worked in the Cootamundra Shoals, which was an oceanographic project, but in which he had the great Australian archaeologist Rhys Jones, who said, take away the water and I will find you an indigenous site. Unfortunately, obviously that couldn't happen, but today with the technology we have, we can take away the water, and we can begin to see where people might have been living and what they might have been potentially accessing or doing in these different environments. And knowing where the sites are on land helps us sort of know regionally that people were in that region at that time period. So last year or the year before, some Indigenous Australian artefacts were found offshore for the first time. And that's really exciting because that means we know that that there is potential, there's possible, it might be preserved. But these are submerged landscape archaeology is now, we've got thousands of sites, especially in the Northern Hemisphere, and we have them dating right back. And if you look at Haysborough, they're about a million years old that we have material coming up, which represents the first hominins in Britain much earlier than we thought they were going to be in Northern Europe. So this is, the potential for finding archaeology in the offshore zone is really great. And I think that's going to change our understanding of the peopling of the planet. The Bronze Age ships that we have, as you know, they're absolutely incredible, and they're so complex. And then what do we have before that? So a few graffitos of Neolithic boats, a couple of log boats. There's the Bracciano log boat in Italy. There's some Chinese Neolithic log boats actually, which are very exciting. There are a couple, then, and there's the Pesce log boat, which is Mesolithic. We've even got that possible Mesolithic log boat down the road at Bolton Cliff, off the Isle of Wight. But why is there there's nothing before that, and then there's this big gap, and then boom, we have complexity. So what's going on? There must be more complexity in there, and I'm dying to find it, because I'm sure it's there. So that's my, I like the origins of seafaring very much. It's really exciting. But the next one is, what's going on? Why do we see very little and then everything? So what's happening between the Neolithic and the Bronze Age? So that's my next aim, I think.
Some fascinating discoveries and ideas explored here by Helen Farr. I hope you've enjoyed this Dive and Dig in-depth podcast, supported by the Honor Frost Foundation, a charity that promotes maritime archaeology in the Eastern Mediterranean. If you want to hear more about the exciting world of maritime archaeology, then join me for the next episode, when we explore some of the current challenges facing maritime cultural heritage and coastal communities, and how Tanzanian rap artist Chemical is using music to raise awareness about the need to protect cultural heritage.